This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 4th, 2016. This Federal Tax Developments podcast is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. We're going to take a look at what's going on here as we enter our brand new year. And so I want to welcome everybody to the brand new 2016 tax year. We're going to start our tax year and we're going to start a brand new tax season for you all at this point. So I'm sure you're all thrilled, ready to go and want to get started here. So let's get ourselves going and discuss what's going on here for taxes this week. And we have a few things that happened in this short week because, as you may guess, everything kind of shut down after Wednesday. Thursday, not much happened. And obviously Friday, New Year's Day, nothing really happened at all for us in federal taxes. But let's go ahead and start with our first developments of this week, which is going to deal with announcement 2016-2. 2016-2, the announcement deals with some expanded rules that are going to allow for data breach services, or should say identity theft services, to be offered to a wider variety of taxpayers. This new announcement expands the offer of tax-free identity theft protection services not only to organizations receiving these from organizations that have experienced a data breach, but now also has been expanded for any organization to which data has been given. Previously, in announcement 2015-22, we were told that if a data breach had occurred, that the provision of data services to the parties would be considered to be not income. But now anyone, any organization to which we have provided personal information can provide this data protection services. What this means as a practical standpoint is everybody's employer is going to obviously be somebody who's been provided with such services, with such information. So basically, employers could provide identity theft protection to their employees as a tax-free fringe at this point, it would appear per this notice. As well, organizations that receive such information from third parties, which would include CPA firms, among others, could also provide that to their customer base without necessarily having to say you have to include an income unless you disclose, or basically, and which you're, by the way, supposed to under state law if it happens, a data breach, or I should say most state laws. But in any event, you could still provide that generally to the customer base. So that would be allowed, and it would not necessarily be considered to be something for which the customers would have to pick that up as income. So it's an interesting expansion. As we see more and more problems we have with ID theft, I expect we're going to see more such guidance of this sort come up from the service as we start developing some reactions to that and in some cases try to get ahead of the game. Next up, we have at least somebody got creative here in their tax planning. And this is Chief Counsel Advice 2015-52026. And this deals with a problem faced by an S corporation that had a worthless QSUP, which would be a qualified subchapter S subsidiary corporation. The problem was that we're not told all the details here, but it would appear it was a financial institution of some sort, and it was about to be taken over by state regulators and put into receivership because it was no longer safe to operate as it was. So this is one of those where basically they're going to shut down the financial institution, take it over. Now, the problem becomes, of course, that when that happens, the shareholders of the S-Corp are going to get nothing for that. And it would appear that if this was not the only asset of the S-Corp, it certainly was its most significant asset. The problem they're looking for is they're trying to figure out some way to convert this to an ordinary loss, because otherwise it looks like, you know, a worthless security. In fact, effectively, what ends up happening, as the IRS pointed out here, the taxpayers were looking at three not very good choices as to the type how the loss would be generated. First, the shareholders could take a worthless stock deduction on their S-Corp shares, which would result in a capital loss. That would be per section 165(g)(1) of the code. They could have the shareholders sell their shares to a third party for a nominal's arm's length price. That would again result in a capital loss, assuming somebody buys their worthless S shares, or have the S-Corporation sell a subsidiary stock, which would be treated as a deemed asset sale under the QSUB rules, or assets to a third party for an arm's length price, which would result in a mix of ordinary and capital losses, depending upon the character of assets held by the subsidiary. As you may guess, if you don't have capital gains, getting a large capital loss probably does you little good, so now we're looking at some way to get a better result. So what the taxpayers' advisors came up with is they would revoke the S election. Now, you revoke an S election, that kills your qualified S corporation subsidiary election. You might wonder, well, what benefits that? Well, the benefit is under Section 165(g)(3) of the code, the worthless stock rule does not apply to stock held in a related or affiliated corporation by a corporation. So when the stock, if there's an affiliated corporation for which the stock becomes worthless, then your loss when you abandon that stock becomes an ordinary loss. Well, that's great. You know, we got worthless stock here. We're going to get an ordinary loss treatment. That would be wonderful. But of course, the potential problem here you've got to think about is, but you know, this is an S corporation and we can't use it with the S structure generally. So we have to find some way to do it. So here's their theory. Since the Q sub's ignored, we're going to terminate the S election. When you terminate the S election, the Q sub election terminates at the end of the day before we start in our C corp form. So what the taxpayer's position was the stock, they would form a Q-sub. The Q-sub would basically convert into a, as if it was incorporated on that day. So we'd have a 351 exchange. Our exchange would take over the basis of the assets held in the Q-sub. Then we would treat it as instantaneously worthless. And under 165(g)(3), be able to pick that up as an ordinary loss. Well, the IRS found basically three independent flaws in this analysis. The first problem, they said, was they do not believe you can have a valid 351 exchange if the corporation, in fact, the assets of the corporation are, in fact, worthless at that time. That in order for there to be an exchange, there must be something of value transferred. Since at this point in time, presumably, the value of the assets of the corporation were less than the value of the liabilities of the corporation because it was about to be taken over by the regulatory agency, the problem became that the IRS position was with no 351 exchange, there never was basis in stock that could be worthless under 165G. Second, they said, well, even if we accept that, the other problem is that S corporations generally are not allowed to pass this loss in. That's their position. They take that position because they note that effectively, I should say, well, we're going to get to that at the end, should say effectively they note that in essence, we have a limitation here. This is really their second one, I should add, that there is regulation 1.165-5D2II specifically limits the application of that ordinary loss rule for affiliated stock if stock is acquired basically solely for the purpose of recognizing a loss. Now, they said in this case, it appears to be that case because of this instantaneous transfer. While the memo points out the taxpayer will probably try to argue there's some other reason for doing it, the reality is that's going to be a really tough sell when you look at the fact that we need this thing to be instantaneously worthless right after the transaction finishes. So right after we have on paper acquired the stock, it becomes worthless. You've got to figure out another reason, a non-tax reason to have that structure. They don't believe that's possible. Finally, the service says, we don't believe an S corporation can do this anyway. Understand that there is this theoretical instantaneous worthlessness deal, but let's assume that works. Because, by the way, that's the other problem I see majorly with this is, how do we establish that it somehow becomes worthless at that instant? Because it has to be at that instant that it becomes worthless. Because otherwise, you know, you've got to have worthlessness at the right point in time. If it's worthless before that point in time, then it would appear, you know, it was already worth nothing by the time we convert it. And if its worthlessness doesn't occur until later when it's taken by the state, well, then that'll drop on the C corp return, which is also bad news for us. But they said the other problem is S corporation rules. When you take a look at the rules for an S corporation, the basic rules that we find into here is that an S corporation is to compute its flow through taxable items as if it was an individual. An individual does not have an option for the 165(g)(3) special rule. And while the code allows some exceptions to that individual treatment, the memo points out that none of those exceptions work in this case. None of them relate to 165(g)(3). So because of that, the National Office concludes that this transaction cannot qualify for ordinary loss treatment, and in fact that the should be disallowed the treatment in the exam in question. Now let's go to another chief counsel advice, but this time where the chief counsel sides with the taxpayer. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2016-01-011, issued on December 31st of 2015. And this deals with questions regarding a 1031 exchange. In this case, a partnership that was owned by two key officers of a related corporation leases the aircraft to a related corporation, that related corporation, in which these two key officers also hold interest in. Now, that plane is used by this corporation for business purposes, but is also used for some personal purposes by the officer, but the company always picked that up properly in the compensation and treated it properly under the rules for that, so that's not a problem. Now it's time to get rid of the aircraft, and we're going to get a new aircraft. And so we do a 1031 exchange of the old aircraft for the new aircraft. We do an exchange. The question is, will it qualify as 1031? Now, the original lease of the aircraft we're getting rid of was at a fair market value, but the successor lease is going to be at less than fair value. In both cases, neither lease was set up at a number that would generate a large profit for the leasing partnership. And in fact, the second one was, as we noted, below market value. The IRS claimed, the agent claimed, that was running this and is asking the question, that they said, well, it's not going to meet the qualification as for business use because that below market rent suggests it's not being held for a profitable purpose, and it would therefore violate Section 183, otherwise known as the hobby loss rules. So this partnership being holding the aircraft in a hobby loss situation, 1031 exchange rules would not apply, so when we trade in the old aircraft for the new, we would have to recognize a gain, presuming that the value of the aircraft is greater than our remaining basis in the aircraft we traded in, that would trigger an immediate taxable gain. However, the National Office did not agree that was the case. The National Office found that, in fact, those rules were not controlling. It notes that there are other very valid business reasons why you would structure a deal this way. And they don't believe that 183 means it was not used for a business purpose. What they point out is that, you know, for liability reasons, it makes a lot of sense to have an aircraft isolated away from the other assets of the business. It makes a sense for other valid business reasons to do so. And in fact, the memo points out, were we to disallow Section 1031 treatment based on the entity structure presented here, businesses would be forced to structure their transaction in inefficient and potentially risky ways to achieve, I get my words right there, Section 1031 treatment. But the memo does go on to note that there is a problem. There are potential problems the taxpayer has here. As they note, it says they're sensitive to the fact raised by the field that the partnership charge a below market rent. And that rather than the business owning the interest in this LLC, the two partners do. So we have that particular problem, right? That those particular officers own that rather than the others. It points out that we may run into problems here, both under the section here of 280F, which would give us a potential problem here, which is the allocation of the under 280F, which is a limitation of property used for non-business purposes, transportation. We think of it normally in luxury auto, but it could apply here. Or Section 482, where we have income allocations between related taxpayers. And that also could potentially mean there could be adjustments on either one of those. But the one thing they make clear here is it did not kill the 1031 exchange because the rent on the second aircraft, the second rent for the successor aircraft was at a below market level. So I guess that's somewhat good news for the taxpayer. The bad news is those other two sections that could pose a problem for the taxpayer in this case. Next up, let's take our one tax court case for the week. This is the estate of Barbara M. Perdue, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-249, issued on December 29th. This is looking again at the legitimacy of a family LLC. Most appropriately looking at whether the IRS can make use of their favorite section, 2036A, to require the entire assets in that family LLC to have to be included in Barbara's estate in whole. Similarly, under a similar rule for gift tax purposes, can we also treat the gifts as basically not counting? So we're going to have those all treated as Barbara's amounts. Now, here's where the fun comes. We're going to take a look at the structured. What the tax court found in this case was there were legitimate non-tax reasons for this structure. A couple of key things that are important when we take a look at this case. Number one, The court goes into long details about a couple of things that I think are very important here. You'll notice that if you have a true non-tax reason, the tax courts have generally held if there's a legitimate non-tax reason for formation, it will go ahead and be a bona fide sale for full and adequate consideration test will be met. And if that's met, 2036A cannot apply. The court points out that any attorney worth his salt is going to recite a whole bunch of non-tax reasons. But as the court points out, that recitation in the document doesn't really mean a darn thing. Rather, we have to take a look at what the parties actually did and whether it appears their actions suggest there was a true non-tax reason for this. In this case, when the attorney formed the partnership, he made a very important point of stating that, you know what, Mr. and Mrs. Perdue, by the way, she took over. She's the second to die. That's why we're here with her case. Mr. and Mrs. Perdue did not necessarily have to understand all the details of the agreements in whole, but all of the children needed to understand that and gave copies of all details to them. Every year, the partnership held a meeting where mom and dad didn't attend, but the kids attended. There were discussions made of the investment strategies of what they were doing. There were also discussions made. They hired an outside investment advisor who took over managing the operation for the whole to keep it as a family group. And they made significant distributions over the terms of the family LLC. The court found for all of these reasons that that at least the stated reason of having joint control, joint management, and being able to accomplish those goals were important. And because they were important, there's a legitimate non-tax reason. The fact that, yeah, the tax reasons were also significant does not kill it. So the tax court was okay with following that. The other issue the IRS tried to raise was they said, okay, well, if that's fine, then under the history we have of the Hackle case and similar cases with Price, with the Price case, that when they gave interest in this partnership every year, because they would give interest and they would get annual exclusion gifts as they gave them to all the kids, etc., in trust. They gave them into a crummy trust. The IRS said, well, based on Hackle and Price, those were not gifts of present interest. Because this was restricted interest, it was put into trust for them. They could not sell that interest. So they said, wait, this is restricted interest. They don't get to take a $14,000 deduction. Tax court disagreed. The tax court noted that we take a look at the assets that were in the family LLC when it was formed. And we look and see that there was tons of cash. It had rental real estate generating cash income coming in. It had bonds, you know, stocks, bonds, etc., that were generating dividends incomes. The court didn't really say so, but I always think it's crucial that it really made distributions and always did. And so because of that, it found that there was present enjoyment. Given there's present enjoyment, it qualifies as a gift of present interest. The difference, if you go back to the Hackle case and Price case, in those cases, you had partnerships that made no distributions. And in the case of Hackle, it had nothing to make a distribution from because there we had a bunch of basically timberland that we, you know, plant new growth planning had been made. There was no income going to come from that for a long time. So in that case, there was no present interest. In this case, the IRS found this qualifies as a gift of present interest. This case is really useful because this is a study in how you handle it correctly if you're doing planning with a taxpayer where you're trying to make use of discounts for estate and gift tax purposes. This is a really good how you do it right case. There are a whole bunch of how you don't do it right. Go back to the Strangi case many years ago to find a really bad case of how you don't do it right. But this tells you all the things you need to be doing for family limited partnership planning to work for your taxpayer. Next up, what may have been the biggest news we had this week, at least when it broke, a lot of people, it got a lot of coverage in the press, and it's going to affect you whether or not you are issuing these or whether your clients are receiving these. Notice 2016-4, issued on December the 28th. The IRS is delaying the due date for the filings of Form 1095 B and C and the transmittals of the coverage for insurance, both from employers and from insurers, and they are delaying the date by which a 1094 B or C, or I should say 1095 B or C has to be filed with the IRS, and the 1094 B or C is a transmittal, but also the date the 1095 B or C has to be provided to the insured or the covered individual. The 1095B and 1095C have to be in the hands of the covered person by March 31st. Under the law, it's supposed to be in their hands by the end of January. But now it's going to be the end of March. That may initially cause you a bit of concern if you're not in the business of issuing these, but your clients are going to be, you know, preparing 1040s. You're going to be preparing 1040s for clients. Because one of the issues we've got this year is we are supposed to discover, right, the 1095 is what the IRS is going to be receiving to say if our client had minimum essential coverage for all of the year. And that means whether they should pay a shared responsibility payment, as well as whether if they got coverage from the marketplace and they received a subsidy or they didn't, what the proper credit slash subsidy amount should be, and whether they should get a decrease in tax or they should be paying some back. Well, none of that information needs to be available to the taxpayer now on the official form 1095B or C until March 31st. Well, that's kind of a problem. So the question becomes, how do we deal with that? The IRS provides that as long as individual taxpayers, you know, attempt to obtain the right information and use information they receive from their insurer or their employer reasonably to determine whether or not they have a shared responsibility payment, whether or not there was an offer of qualifying coverage that could potentially make them ineligible for a credit from the exchange. As long as they do that reasonably and they maintain that information with the return, they will not be required to amend their return later on in the year when they receive the 1095 B or C. They are not to send that information in with their 1040, but rather they are to preserve it. Theoretically, that means if the IRS writes you and says, you know what, based on this 1095 B or C, we think you owe us money, you then produce that information that was relied upon. That means the clients need to maintain that information. Might not be a bad idea for you to ask them for that information and remind them, if we don't have a 1095 B or C by the time we do their 1040, that they need to retain the information we're using to presume that we are reporting things properly on their return. Now, the actual forms to the IRS are delayed. If you're filing the 1094B and the 1094B or 1094C on paper, that due date now, instead of being the end of February, pushes back to May 31st. And if you file electronically, instead of being the end of March, the due date on that will now push back to June 30th. Well, hopefully you're ready for the brand new year, because this has been our first 2016 edition of Current Federal Tax Developments. You want to go to our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where you'll find information regarding all the things we talked about this week, as well as links to the source documents that were in play this week. We'll also publish information there as updates occur during the week. Be sure to join us again next week as we'll talk again about the developments in the area of federal taxes.